Mr. Giesen, I understand you were court-appointed, is that right?
That's correct,
Your Honor. Appreciate your taking the assignment and your advocacy for your client.
Thank you.
We'll move on to the next case. Which is Scott Manley versus Joanne Barnhart. Mr. Schultz.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Scott Manley. The plaintiff asserts that the administrative law judge in this case made four basic errors in his decision. First, he improperly failed to analyze and assess any limitations caused by the plaintiff's profound fatigue, in particular the plaintiff's allegations that he slept between 15 to 20 hours a day, which would include 10 to 12 hours at night and 2 to 4, or 10 to 16 hours at night and 2 to 4 hours during the day. In addition, that he had to rest for an hour after engaging in minimal activities, including things such as reading for 15 minutes or doing dishes for a short period of time, or even after watching television for an hour. The ALJ accepted the diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome for Mr. Manley, and fatigue is the number one symptom in chronic fatigue syndrome, and it was Mr. Manley's most pervasive symptom. And the ALJ should have, but failed to, make any particular or specific credibility finding as to Mr. Manley's testimony about how much he had to sleep and the fact that he had to sleep during the day.
Here's my question for you, Mr. Schultz, because as you point out, some of the reasons that the ALJ articulated for discrediting Mr. Manley were erroneous. But why aren't any such errors harmless? In other words, didn't the ALJ rely principally on the reports of the other doctors who determined who examined Mr. Manley rather than on Mr. Manley's credibility or lack thereof?
Well, actually, the ALJ relied on the report of a doctor who did not examine Mr. Manley, a state agency non-examining physician, Dr. Crennan, and he found that he gave her opinion substantial weight, contrary to the opinion of the treating physician, Dr. Kohler.
But why isn't the ALJ free to discount the examining doctor, Dr. Kohler's findings, given that there was, you know, quite a conflict between those findings and the findings of certain other physicians who, examined Mr. Manley?
Okay. I think for several reasons. First, Social Security ruling 404-1527D, specifically requires that ALJs consider a number of factors in determining what weight to give a treating physician's opinion and other physicians' opinions. According to that regulation, if a treating physician's opinion is not entitled to controlling weight, meaning if it's inconsistent with substantial evidence in the record, or if it's not fully supported by the objective evidence, all that means is that it's not entitled to controlling weight. It still might be entitled to giving great weight and possibly should be adopted by the administrative law judge. In this case, the ALJ only went through the first analysis in finding that Dr. Kohler's opinion was not entitled to controlling weight. He never then went through the factors set forth in the regulation to determine what weight should have been given Dr. Kohler's report. And that's important because the regulation specifically states that generally the opinion of an examining physician is entitled to greater weight than the opinion of a non-examining physician, and that the opinion of a treating physician is generally entitled to more weight than the opinion of a non-treating physician. Then it goes on to explain that if a doctor has the longitudinal view to provide a proper assessment, that that doctor's opinion is entitled to greater weight. In this situation, Dr. Kohler treated the claimant for a long period of time, provided treatment, referred him to specialists for his condition, oversaw many of the tests that were done for him, and it was the ALJ was required to analyze the opinion based on the regulation. Social Security ruling 96-2P makes that clear in stating that just because a treating physician's opinion might be inconsistent with other evidence of record doesn't mean it should be rejected, but that it needs to be properly evaluated. In addition, in this case, the reasons that the ALJ gave for rejecting Dr. Kohler's opinion are not supported in the record. He indicates that Dr. Kohler primarily relied on the plaintiff's subjective complaints as opposed to any objective evidence. That's not really accurate, because in addition to chronic fatigue syndrome, which is largely a subjectively based condition, Mr. Manley also suffered from a cardiac condition. He had his aortic valve replaced when he was 31 years old, and he continued to suffer from some cardiac symptoms, including premature atrial and ventricular contractions, rapid heartbeat, and arrhythmia, according to Dr. Kohler. Those are objective findings which would support Dr. Kohler's opinion. But in addition, the Commissioner of Social Security has set forth a ruling, 99-2P, which specifically informs adjudicators, including ALJs, as to what they're supposed to consider in evaluating chronic fatigue syndrome cases. And that ruling states that the opinions of treating physicians on the functional limitations caused by chronic fatigue syndrome are particularly important and must be considered by the adjudicators in making their residual functional capacity assessments. So it's not sufficient to reject a treating physician's opinion in a case of chronic fatigue syndrome because that doctor relied on some subjective complaints of the claimant. In fact, all doctors assessing chronic fatigue syndrome will rely to some extent on those subjective complaints. It's the very nature of the illness.
But didn't Dr. Kohler say that he doesn't have heart problems?
No, Dr. Kohler did not say that.
Well, didn't he say, Dr. Kohler said that Manley was much the same with his usual fatigue and precluding regular activity. He did note that Manley's perception of increasing cardiac irregularity, but stated that his valve sounds are clear, there's no obvious diastolic murmur audible, and his peripheral pulses are intact.
Yeah, I don't disagree that he may have said that, but he was still...
That was his finding.
At one point. But he was treating him for these other cardiac conditions that I mentioned, a rapid heart rate and occasional arrhythmia. But even so, there was still the issue of the chronic fatigue syndrome, on which Dr. Kohler also based his conclusion that Mr. Manley was limited to sedentary work. I also just briefly wanted to address the ALJ rejected Dr. Kohler's opinion because he found that there was an inconsistency between him finding a class 2 slight cardiac impairment and finding a limitation to sedentary work. However, a class 2 cardiac impairment, by definition of the American Heart Association, is one which causes symptoms on ordinary physical activity. So there's nothing inherently inconsistent between Dr. Kohler stating there was a limitation to sedentary work and the assessment of a class 2 cardiac impairment. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Pedersen?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Danielle Pedersen, and I'm here on behalf of Joanne Barnhart, the Commissioner of Social Security. The ALJ in this case gave sufficient and reasonable basis for rejecting the opinions of Dr. Kohler. Dr. Kohler filled out a single checkbox opinion and opined, in the essence, that Mr. Manley was capable of the full range of sedentary work. He said he could stand for up to an hour, walk for up to 2.5 hours in an 8-hour day, sit for 5.5 hours, and lift, push, pull, and carry no more than 10 pounds. The ALJ did not completely reject Dr. Kohler's opinion, as Mr. Manley would have you believe. The ALJ, in fact, basically disagreed with the lifting limitation, the limitation that Mr. Manley was restricted to nothing more than sedentary lifting and carrying. That is the only significant difference between the ALJ's RFC finding and that of Dr. Kohler. In fact, the ALJ's RFC finding in this case is somewhat more accommodating of Mr. Manley's limitations stemming from fatigue than those of Dr. Kohler. The ALJ, in fact, specifically found that Mr. Manley needed to be limited to simple, routine, repetitive, low-stress work in recognition of the fact that he complained of mental fatigue in addition to the physical fatigue. The ALJ also found that he could sit or stand for no more than 1 hour at a time, and this comes directly out of Mr. Manley's own testimony at the hearing.
Now, with respect to that, with respect to the opinion of the vocational expert, can we be confident that the expert considered whether Mr. Manley is able to alternate between sitting and standing at will, given that the ALJ didn't specifically include that ability in the hypothetical that that he posed?
Your concern mirrors one that was raised by Mr. Manley in his brief. We believe you can be very confident in the VE's testimony, and here's why. This is sort of a semantic red herring, Your Honor. The words at will do not appear in the hypothetical question, but here's what does appear. Both the RFC finding and the hypothetical question both include two completely separate limitations that relate to the ability to sit and stand. They both include the requirement, and these are identical in both the RFC and the hypothetical question, that Mr. Manley must not be required to sit or stand for more than an hour at a time. That standing by itself is a limitation that says he must be able to switch positions at least every hour. But in addition to that, the ALJ included in the hypothetical question another limitation, which said that Mr. Manley must also, in addition to that, must also be allowed to change positions throughout the day. Now, you're right, the words at will aren't in there, but throughout the day, needing to switch positions throughout the day, in addition to the other limitation that was also in there, which was that he couldn't sit or stand for more than an hour at a time, this provided sufficient information to the vocational expert to make him understand that he needed to identify jobs that could be formed in either a sitting or standing position. And that is what the VE did. This argument, therefore, we believe is without merit. The other minor discrepancy with the RFC and the hypothetical question that came up in Mr. Manley's brief, which isn't mentioned today, but I'll go into it briefly, is the fact that the moderate concentration and attention difficulties were not actually in the hypothetical question. Now, counsel relies on Kozarski, but that case is clearly distinguishable. The court in Kozarski was concerned because there were no mental limitations in the RFC and in the hypothetical question. And that court said, wait a minute, you're saying this guy often has deficiencies of concentration, but then you're not putting any significant limitations in the RFC and the hypothetical. The ALJ in this case did precisely what the ALJ in Kozarski did not. The ALJ in this case found that there were these moderate concentration difficulties. He properly converted those findings into an RFC finding, a finding of actual limitations, and told the VE to only identify jobs that could be performed that were simple, repetitive, routine, and low stress. This court has recognized most recently in Johansson that those types of limitations are the kind that appropriately appear in the hypothetical and the RFC, and that an ALJ is not required to put in these, we call them PRTF findings, a psychiatric review technique. These sort of, they have moderate limitations. The VE does, that doesn't mean anything to a VE. Moderate limitations doesn't mean anything to a VE. A VE wants to know, how is this person limited? And that's what the ALJ did in this case. He told the VE how Mr. Manley was limited by his concentration difficulties. Now, there's a lot of talk in Mr. Manley's brief and this morning about the various diagnoses that were involved here. And let's not get sidetracked. Let's not lose focus what's important in this case. The diagnoses are not relevant in this case. The ALJ didn't reject any of these diagnoses. We aren't debating whether the chronic fatigue stemmed from a class 2 cardiac impairment versus chronic fatigue. The ALJ accepted that there was a cardiac condition and chronic fatigue syndrome. What the ALJ did properly was focus on the symptoms, primarily fatigue, and determine the extent to which those symptoms limited Mr. Manley. Again, going back to Dr. Kohler's opinion, the ALJ properly contrasted the finding that there were only slight cardiac limitations with the finding that he was limited in this lifting capacity to only sedentary lifting. The ALJ found this for several reasons. First, counsel makes much of the sort of the American Heart Association definition, but it doesn't aid Mr. Manley's case to talk about what a typical person with a Class 2 cardiac impairment experiences. In fact, a typical person with a Class 2 cardiac impairment, according to Mr. Manley's own brief, has shortness of breath and chest pain. We know from this record that Mr. Manley doesn't have shortness of breath or chest pain. He denied those repeatedly. On rare occasion, he had slight shortness of breath. Mr. Manley's not a typical cardiac patient as it regards this definition. The ALJ reasonably took that slight limitation opinion, contrasted it with the fact that the objective evidence of cardiac impairment was very limiting. There wasn't much about it. Mr. Manley occasionally reported kind of an accelerated heartbeat, and as you've already noted, Your Honor, frequently that wasn't borne out. Dr. Kohler noted that he was complaining of these arrhythmias, but they weren't always present during the exams. They were on occasion. The ALJ properly found there was a slight cardiac limitation that's consistent with what Dr. Kohler said, and he contrasted that with his sedentary opinion. The lifting limitation to light work is fully supported by the opinions of two reviewing state agency physicians, as well as Mr. Manley's own testimony. He did testify thought he could lift 25 pounds. Certainly, light work requires lifting 20 pounds no more than occasionally. The frequent lifting that's required is at 10 pounds. That's consistent with what Dr. Kohler found, and there's certainly not a legal error on the part of the ALJ in making that assessment. The ALJ also accepted the diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, and we fully appreciate, and it's well settled, that chronic fatigue syndrome is not typically characterized by objective findings. But what the ALJ did properly in this case, and I think, Judge Rovner, you touched on this a little, was look at what doctors were observing about Mr. Manley during these exams. The doctors, even Dr. Kohler, were observing that Mr. Manley seemed to be in good spirits. He seemed to be in good health. He was functioning fairly well during exams. I think most telling is his performance in these three mental exams that he went through, where the doctors noted very little signs of mental fatigue. He did very well on testing. His memory and concentration and attention were very good on these exams, and all of these doctors suggested that he would be capable of sustained work activity. In fact, one doctor only said that he might start to experience mental fatigue after 8 hours. We're not expecting Mr. Manley to work at more than 8 hours. I mean, we're talking about an 8-hour workday, and the ALJ nonetheless accommodated that mental fatigue and put some limitations in the RFC to account for it. I think another portion of the argument that the ALJ didn't find Mr. Manley capable of sustained work is peculiar at best, considering that the treating physician's opinion here was that Mr. Manley could sustain full-time work. Again, he could sit. There's some discrepancy in the briefs about the number of hours. You know, I think at one point Mr. Manley suggests that Dr. Kohler found he could only perform work for 7.5 hours, and that math is not borne out by his opinion at transcript page 303 to 304. He said he could stand for up to 2.5 hours in an 8-hour day. Walk for up to 2.5 hours, stand for up to 2 hours, sit for up to 5.5 hours. I'm a lawyer and don't do math very well, but I think that's an 8-hour workday. So at the end of the day, Dr. Kohler did find he could perform sustained work activity. There's not a great discrepancy between his opinion and that of the ALJ. The ALJ did not outright reject Dr. Kohler's opinion and therefore did not need to go into the reasons why he did so. He basically agreed with Dr. Kohler's opinions except for the lifting. He explained why he disregarded that opinion, and he actually went on to be more accommodating of Mr. Manley's limitations. The ALJ provided sufficient articulation in this case to allow you to trace the path of his reasoning, and we would respectfully request that you affirm the Commissioner's decision that Mr. Manley is not disabled.
Thank you. Mr. Schultz, have anything to add? What time we got? You got 1 minute.
In response to Judge Rovner's question previously, at page 61 of the administrative record, the hypothetical question asked of the vocational expert said that but could only sit up to 1 hour at a time or stand up to 1 hour at a time, could alternate throughout an 8-hour day. Well, alternating sitting and standing throughout an 8-hour day, being able to do either for an hour at a time, is very different than what the ALJ actually found, which is that the claimant had to be able to sit or stand at will, which might mean he could only sit for 5 minutes, alternated by standing for 5 minutes, etc., throughout the day. And the vocational expert was required or should have had the full all the limitations that the ALJ found in order to find that, in fact, there were jobs that Mr. Manley could perform. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.